From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here Now. With less than 3 weeks to go until November 3rd, the pandemic continues to complicate the election. Senator and vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris has suspended travel plans through Sunday after two people close to her tested positive for COVID-19. Meanwhile, President Trump is holding a rally today in Greenville, North Carolina. Early voting starts today in that state. Trump won North Carolina in 2016, but is trailing in the polls this year.
And while Joe Biden is leading in national polls, his campaign is behind by at least one metric in some key states: voter registration. Republicans have registered more voters than Democrats since the primary elections earlier this year in places like North Carolina, Florida, and Pennsylvania. Let's bring in David Wasserman for more on this. He's House editor for the nonpartisan Cook Political Report. Dave, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I mentioned Florida, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Tell me more. Where are Republicans leading in these new voter registration numbers, and by how much?
Well, roughly since the primaries, Republicans have outregistered Democrats in these three states, plus Arizona, 445,000 to 224,000. And what that says is that not only is voter registration a ray of hope for Republicans, we're seeing registrants down across the board since 2016. Democrats in particular are having a harder time registering their traditional base of support, college students. It's harder to hold in-person registration campaigns. It's also been a lopsided ground effort because Republicans in the Trump campaign have engaged in door knocking, whereas the Biden campaign, for the most part, has banned in-person contact in the pandemic.
Well, this might surprise a lot of people to see this data, because we've been hearing about potentially record-breaking turnout this year. We've seen incredibly long lines at the polls already for people who are voting early. And we've also seen Joe Biden leading consistently in the national polls.
That's right. And look, this is a drop in the bucket compared to Biden's lead in the national polls. So it's not as if a Republican voter registration edge is somehow going to overwhelm the margin we're seeing in surveys for Biden nationally. But voter registration is a difficult metric to interpret because for many years in states such as Pennsylvania and Florida and North Carolina, we've seen Democrats' registration advantage narrow. And that's in part the result of older conservative Democrats who we might think of as Dixiecrats in Florida, but also blue dog Democrats in Pennsylvania. They're exiting the electorate, or they have voted for Trump in 2016, but are formally switching their registration to Republican. But also a number of young voters who are turning 18 and registering to vote for the first time, they dislike Trump and for the most part are voting for Biden this year. But increasingly, young voters are registering as unaffiliated or independent. And so that has the effect of narrowing Democrats' historical registration advantage without necessarily giving Trump new votes.
Now, I hear you saying that this is just a drop in the bucket for Joe Biden's overall lead in the polls, but I'm also looking at states like Florida and even Pennsylvania, which could be incredibly close this year, where that margin might actually matter.
That's true. And look, these states could be highly competitive by Election Day. It's possible that this race could tighten back up, in which case the small changes around the margins could matter a great deal. Look, we're going to need to be careful about interpreting data on early voting and mail ballot returns that looks awfully good for Democrats, because Republicans do have an advantage when it comes to the Election Day vote. And we're going to see a record polarization between Democrats who are turning out early and Republicans who are turning out on Election Day.
Yeah. Before I let you go, David, as one of the top election forecasters in the country, really, what other trends are you watching for in the final weeks of this election?
In particular, we're watching two demographic groups who are underperforming for the president right now. Joe Biden has expanded his lead in recent weeks by diminishing Trump's strength with seniors and with blue-collar white women who are not evangelicals. as the focus has shifted back to COVID, the president's numbers with 65-plus voters have really tanked. In the average of final polls in 2016, Trump was leading among seniors 49 to 44. In polls this September, Biden was leading seniors 51-46. Today, on average, he's leading seniors 54-43. Among blue-collar white women, the shift in the focus back to Roe v. Wade and the Affordable Care Act has noticeably hurt Trump and Republicans. That is critical in the battleground states, because who votes in Florida and Arizona? Seniors, of course. Who votes in the upper Midwest? Well, a higher than average rate of blue-collar women.
That's David Wasserman, House Editor for the Cook Political Report. David, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The Senate Judiciary Committee announced plans today to subpoena Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey after the company began blocking users from sharing a New York Post story on Hunter Biden's potential business ties in Ukraine. The story also includes unsubstantiated claims about Hunter Biden's father, who, of course, is also the Democratic presidential nominee. After receiving backlash from conservatives, including from President Trump, Dorsey apologized and said Twitter's communication around its actions on the New York Post article was not great. Facebook also said it's reduced distribution of the Post stories. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, Twitter and Facebook are saying the New York Post story violates their rules and is spreading misinformation. What do you make of what the companies are doing here?
This is fascinating, Peter. They're actually doing different things for different reasons. Twitter's reasoning is entirely technical. So you can still read about the story and read articles about it. What you can't see is the New York Post story. It's the first time Twitter has actually blocked you from sending a link from a news publication. And part of that is that it's complicated if you haven't read the story, but there's a problem with how the New York Post got the information. It said that somebody who may be Hunter Biden dropped it off at a computer store, and the computer store then gave some of that information to Rudy Giuliani and some of it to the feds. Twitter is saying that if this is hacked material, meaning if it was not procured properly, you can't distribute that on their platform. So that's Twitter's position. Facebook's is entirely different. Facebook is saying this is important, may have misinformation, so it needs to be subject to Facebook's third-party fact-checking partners. And while they are having it fact-checked, they are reducing its distribution through its algorithms. So, you know, Facebook's algorithms determine how often you'll see a story, whether it'll show up in your feed based on your preferences and things like that. Facebook is sort of ratcheting that down until they have been able to either put a warning on it or say that it's factually accurate and ready to go out. So two different platforms, both really influential, doing two different things that will limit people's ability to see the story.
And meanwhile, there's been an outcry, claims of censorship. We hear the Senate now subpoenaing Jack Dorsey. On the other hand, there are legitimate concerns over the veracity of those sources in the New York Post story. And all the while, this is becoming a politicized controversy.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and it may have gotten larger by virtue of these actions by Twitter and Facebook, because now everybody's attention is on it, whereas it might have looked like a New York Post story. That's an outlet that is favorable to Donald Trump, fed by Rudy Giuliani, who's been on this mission to get information from Ukraine. So, yeah, there are real issues to be looked at in the story. And I think part of what Twitter and Facebook are trying to figure out is how do you get that information out there, the valid part of the discussion, without simply amplifying something that they are not sure is information or misinformation right now. And that's really the heart of the problem with this thing. What is Twitter and Facebook and social media's responsibility when it comes to the veracity of a story as it relates to the distribution of that story? What we do know from the last election is that fake stories and sensational stories get a lot more pickup than straight news stories. So they're struggling with that.
All right. This is going to be a story that will be worth watching as it unfolds in the days and weeks ahead. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you, as always, for your time.
My
we appreciate
pleasure.
That's and they part the result of race faults for part older conservatives who we have might for in Florida, Dixiecrat, but also blue for Democrats in Pennsylvania. They're exiting the electorate for voted for they have for Trump in 2016, but for formally switching their registration for Republican. But also for a number of reporters who are young so to vote teen and red for the first young to vote teen and red for the first and red for the first that's his and red for the first that's his and red for the first that's his and red that's his and red that's his and red that's his and red.
As they crisscross the country this week, both President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are campaigning on the issue of trade. Speaking in Toledo, Ohio on Monday, Biden promised a trade strategy that gets results for American workers.
Not Trump's chaotic trade war, erratic tweets and bluster that's only stiffed American workers and consumers, including farmers. He's let you down. He's let us down.
President Trump in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, had his own criticism of Biden's record.
Biden supported NAFTA, TPP, and China's entry into the WTO, which is one of the worst things that ever happened to this country.
Dueling pictures there of U.S. trade policy. Let's take a closer look at the issue with NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. And Scott, I want to start with what President Trump said about Joe Biden's support for trade deals like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Remind us, what was Biden's record on those issues and what could we expect from a President Biden?
Joe Biden did support NAFTA as well as normalized trade relations with China. Of the two, NAFTA was the more contentious at the time. Biden agreed to go along after former President Bill Clinton made some adjustments to the deal in the early 1990s. China was less controversial, although more consequential in the end. I think if he were elected, Biden would be less protectionist than Donald Trump has been, but not necessarily 180 degrees opposite from the president, especially when it comes to China, where the long-held consensus that economic liberalization would lead to political liberalization has sort of been tested over two decades now and is subject to a lot more second-guessing.
Well, as we know, President Trump has been very critical of many trade deals. He left NAFTA and then renegotiated a pretty similar deal with Mexico and Canada. What would you say we've learned from the president's first term in relation to trade deals?
Trump is, as advertised, a tariff man. He imposed steep tariffs on China, but also lots of other countries, including U.S. allies. The president insists that our trading partners bear the cost of those import taxes, but in fact, much of the cost has been borne by American companies and consumers. The trade war has also triggered a backlash in other countries, which in many cases have responded with tariffs of their own on U.S. exports. The new NAFTA deal the president signed is more of an update to the old agreement than just a complete rewrite. It does include things like digital commerce that were in their infancy when the original NAFTA took effect. But most of the changes were pretty modest, and many were already included in that big Asia-Pacific trade deal the president mentioned, which also included Mexico and NAFTA, Mexico and Canada, and which Trump pulled out of on one of his first days in office.
And tell me more about how we can measure the impact on U.S. workers of Trump's tariffs and the trade war with China and our allies. Is there a way we can say it's affected jobs in this or that way?
The trade war certainly hurt manufacturers here in the U.S. They are heavily dependent on exports, and the data shows pretty clearly that factories were in a slump last year, even before the pandemic hit. We know that farmers have also been hurt by retaliatory tariffs from China and from other countries, although the president has partially offset those farm losses with billions of dollars in new federal aid for farmers. China did agree as a result of that Phase One trade agreement signed earlier this year to buy a lot more U.S. beef and soybeans and crude oil and other products. So far, though, Beijing is lagging well behind those purchase commitments. And it also hasn't made the big structural changes that the administration was hoping to see when it launched this trade war, although China has agreed to some stronger protections for intellectual property. Some of the U.S. companies that were buying products from China have begun to rethink their supply chains as a result of the trade war. But to the extent that they've abandoned China, they've mostly gone to Vietnam or Mexico or other countries rather than bringing jobs back to the U.S.
Well, and if there is a second term for President Trump, do you expect more of the same, more tough lines against China?
Yeah, I think there'll be more pressure on China, especially when it comes to the technology sector. But if the last 4 years are any guide, the pressure will be unilateral as opposed to done in coordination with other countries. And it's also likely to be pretty erratic. You know, the Trump trade policy is very personal and transactional, and it often goes hot or cold depending on, you know, how things went with the president's last meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping.
Oh, and on the other hand, there's the question of what Joe Biden would do with China. There's still tariffs on the vast majority of goods coming from that country, and Biden would certainly have to consider what to do about that.
That's right. And it's not clear that Joe Biden would unwind those tariffs overnight. Some of his fellow Democrats don't want him to. It is likely, though, that Biden would take less of a go-it-alone approach to trade policy. To the extent he challenged China, he would probably do so more in concert with U.S. allies than Trump has done. A lot of those allies have their own concerns about Beijing. More broadly, I think it's safe to say that a Biden trade policy trade policy would be more predictable and less adversarial than Trump's has been. And that is one reason forecasters at Goldman Sachs are predicting stronger economic growth under a President Biden than we would see under a second term for President Trump.
We have just about 30 seconds here, Scott. We hear both of these candidates talking about this issue. They're trying to reach to blue-collar workers in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio. How much weight does it carry with voters?
You know, U.S. attitudes toward trade before the pandemic were about as positive as they had been in a generation. That is probably partly a reflection of relatively good economic times. We usually are more favorable to trade when unemployment is low, and also may reflect some wariness with the president's policies.
Yeah. NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Well, this year, the pandemic has forced the cancellation of a lot of public events. But that hasn't stopped many people from getting together and partying, a problem Key West, Florida may be facing soon. Fantasy Fest, the Keys' biggest party of the year, was scheduled to start tomorrow. It was canceled because of the virus, but as Nancy Klinginger from member station WLRN reports, the city is getting ready for people determined to show up anyway.
Key West needs its tourists. They bring in $1 billion a year. But some people who live here are not so psyched to see so many visitors, not during a pandemic.
Well, I got a text the other day that one of our signs on the side of the road said, "Welcome, glad you're here." And someone took exception to that.
Gregory Velez is the Key West city manager. For the last 40 years, tens of thousands of tourists have come to Key West in late October for Fantasy Fest. This year, it was canceled, but people are coming anyway. Hotels are booking up, and people from out of town are making plans on social media.
Either are people very alarmed that there are masses of people descending on the city. There are some business owners that are very happy that there are potentially masses of people descending on the city.
Now we got a group of people who are used to bucking social norms.
Dr. Jack Norris is the chief of staff at the local hospital, so he's been treating COVID patients since the start of the pandemic. And his office is half a block off Duval Street, right where the city usually sets up a fantasy zone, where body paint counts as clothing, and you can drink from open containers on the street.
They're singing, they're yelling, they're having fun. I have a permanent scar in my mind of a guy trying to become very friendly with a police car. That's Fantasy Fest. It's no Sesame Street.
Dr. Norris is worried this year that risque behavior is too risky.
Number one, are they bringing us disease since they are more risk tolerant than I would be? Number two, if they do get sick down here, will they be able to go home? And if they can't go home, where are they going to stay and what are they going to do? We don't have anything that's like a COVID hotel.
Norris is also worried about the locals.
If the employees of a particular establishment say these people are too high risk, they're not wearing masks, they're coughing and breathing all over me, my ventilation may not be so well, what am I going to do? Am I going to really service these guys?
There's this bar in the heart of the party zone on Lower Duval Street. There's music all day and night. Daylon Starks is the general manager at Irish Kevin's.
if they want to come down and spend their money, there are a lot of people down here that could really use it.
Fantasy Fest is the biggest week of the year for hotels and bars in Key West. Starks gets why people are concerned.
But I also think that sometimes it's a personal choice. You know, like, I don't choose to go somewhere that I know is going to be very busy because I personally don't want to be there. But if you choose to, then that's cool too.
Those personal choices are going to play out in public, and Key West is going to have to deal with it. As the city manager, Gregory Velez knows part of running Key West is knowing that as long as no one is stopping them, people are going to come.
Am I afraid of it? No, I mean, it's going to happen. And you understand that most of these things, all of these things are happening on private property within establishments. Now, do we anticipate that they're going to spill out onto the street? Yeah, we do. And are we prepared for that? Absolutely.
The Keys were closed to outsiders for 2 months in the spring. Since they've reopened, the tourists are back, even during what is usually the slowest time of the year.
Here we are into October, and we're packed every weekend.
It's a lot of people from other parts of Florida taking trips where they can drive. And when the sidewalks on Duval Street get too packed, the city closes the street to traffic so that people can spread out.
And mostly that's just to get people off of the sidewalk and to allow social distancing. The crowd dictates it, we close it. And that's been more weekends than not lately.
Key West can't stop people from coming here, wearing costumes, and meeting up with friends for parties. And no one expects that the island will see tens of thousands of extra people, like in a normal year. But Norris says he's hearing from a lot of people who are still worried.
The businesses don't want to close because of a surge, and the employees don't want to get sick and don't want their business closed due to a surge. So when it comes down to it, what is going to happen? We have so many what ifs, what ifs, what ifs.
All those what ifs are what makes this such a weird year.
I can do Fantasy Fest pretty much now in my sleep. We've got Fantasy Fest down. The un-Fantasy Fest or the unevent is harder to plan for.
And that unevent gets underway tomorrow. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The Senate Judiciary Committee announced plans today to subpoena Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey after the company began blocking users from sharing a New York Post story on Hunter Biden's potential business ties in Ukraine. The story also includes unsubstantiated claims about Hunter Biden's father, who, of course, is also the Democratic presidential nominee. After receiving backlash from conservatives, including from President Trump, Dorsey apologized and said Twitter's communication around its actions on the New York Post article was not great. Facebook also said it's reduced distribution of the Post stories. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, Twitter and Facebook are saying the New York Post story violates their rules and is spreading misinformation. What do you make of what the companies are doing here?
This is fascinating, Peter. They're actually doing different things for different reasons. Twitter's reasoning is entirely technical. So you can still read about the story and read articles about it. What you can't see is the New York Post story. It's the first time Twitter has actually blocked you from sending a link from a news publication. And part of that is that it's complicated if you haven't read the story, but there's a problem with how the New York Post got the information. It said that somebody who may be Hunter Biden dropped it off at a computer store, and the computer store then gave some of that information to Rudy Giuliani and some of it to the feds. Twitter is saying that if this is hacked material, meaning if it was not procured properly, you can't distribute that on their platform. So that's Twitter's position. Facebook's is entirely different. Facebook is saying This is important, may have misinformation, so it needs to be subject to Facebook's third-party fact-checking partners. And while they are having it fact-checked, they are reducing its distribution through its algorithms. So, you know, Facebook's algorithms determine how often you'll see a story, whether it'll show up in your feed based on your preferences and things like that. Facebook is sort of ratcheting that down until they have been able to either put a warning on it or say that it's factually accurate and ready to go out. So two different platforms, both really influential, doing two different things that will limit people's ability to see the story.
And meanwhile, there's been an outcry, claims of censorship. We hear the Senate now subpoenaing Jack Dorsey. On the other hand, there are legitimate concerns over the veracity of those sources in the New York Post story. And all the while, this is becoming a politicized controversy.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and it may have gotten larger by virtue of these actions by Twitter and Facebook, because now everybody's attention is on it, whereas it might have looked like a New York Post story. That's an outlet that is favorable to Donald Trump, fed by Rudy Giuliani, who's been on this mission to get information from Ukraine. So, yeah, there are real issues to be looked at in the story. And I think part of what Twitter and Facebook are trying to figure out is how do you get that information out there, the valid part of the discussion, without simply amplifying something that they are not sure is information or misinformation right now. And that's really the heart of the problem with this thing. What is Twitter and Facebook and social media's responsibility when it comes to the veracity of a story as it relates to the distribution of that story? What we do know from the last election is that fake stories and sensational stories get a lot more pickup than straight news stories. So they're struggling with that.
All right. This is going to be a story that will be worth watching as it unfolds in the days and weeks ahead. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you, as always, for your time.
My pleasure. Appreciate it.
Amanda Gorman, the nation's first youth poet laureate, is now a Harvard graduate. The 22-year-old did a virtual walk earlier this year, and now in the midst of the pandemic and calls for racial justice, Gorman is using her talents as a poet to offer words of hope and understanding. Amanda Gorman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
Yes. So your work focuses on issues of race and feminism and oppression. You're one of the rare few who knew your path very early in life. How has the last 4 years, and specifically the last few months with this country's grappling with racism, shaped your view of your purpose in this moment?
As a writer, I'm also writing as an African-American, so these issues are very much so intimate and personal. For me, I think we have our own kind of weapons that we can take into the arena to fight systemic racism. And for me, the greatest instrument that I have at my disposal is my pen. And so I try to create messages of both kind of critical thinking, but also of hope, to be both thinking deeply and also constructively about what we can do with the racial tensions in our country.
One example of that, I'm going to have you read one of your poems. You're a self-proclaimed history buff, and you have a poem to share with us that takes a look at a portion of Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, where he claimed it was impossible for Black people to write poetry, including Phyllis Wheatley, the first Black American to have a book of poetry published in 1773. Can you read that poem for us?
Certainly. Notes on the State of Virginia. Notes on the state, I find, uttered a thought the level of plain. Never painting or sculpture, music gifted. Whites have been found capable of imagining. Whether they will be the composition of a more extensive or complicated harmony is yet to be proved. Misery is often. Poetry is misery enough. God knows poetry. Love is peculiar of the poet, ardent, but it kindles only the imagination. Religion, indeed. A Phyllis could produce, published under her name, the dignity of.
You know, you're a manifestation of everything Thomas Jefferson tried to deny as a possibility. How does it feel to reshape this assertion? In a way, you're really correcting history through poetry.
I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I try to kind of, live history through my poetry. I should contextualize this poem in that when Thomas Jefferson was basically condemning Phyllis Wheatley's poetry, she was around my age, if not younger than I was. And so for him to dedicate time in this historical document to try to erase her from having any type of poetic claim, I think says a lot about what one skinny, small, young Black girl poet can do to disrupt humanity. And I should say that I talk a lot about imagination in this poem when I'm kind of erasing Thomas Jefferson's words and creating this poem. That is also in part inspired by Claudia Rankine's Citizen, which very much so deals with police brutality. And she has an incredible line there that says, because white men can't police their imagination, Black people are dying.
You know, the arts have always been used as a way for us to make sense of the world. You teach young people about how to use poetry for transformative change. What's the response to the medium from the young people you work with?
The response is always incredibly rewarding. You know, my role isn't to convert everyone to become a poet laureate, but I want every single young person to have the capacity to share their voice. And if poetry can help make that journey accessible, I'm here for it.
You also consider yourself an activist, and I would imagine that you don't separate yourself, like I'm a poet and I'm an activist. How do you see these working in concert with each other?
I definitely see them working together. It's always so strange to me when someone says, oh, I'd love for you to write this poem, but don't make it political. And I kind of freeze because it makes no sense to me. Everything is political, especially art. And I think often that's a word that is misappropriated to say, don't have this poem push buttons. Don't have this poem ask difficult questions and begin complicated conversations. So for me, kind of a sociopolitical interest is already embedded in my poetry, and it's, you know, impossible, if not so counterpoint to who I am, to eradicate, I should say, that concern from that art.
It's been important for you as a writer and activist to have something to guide you, and you call it a mantra. So I wonder, what is your mantra?
This literary talisman I came up with a few years ago, and I recite it to myself in times of great fear and anxiety. And it goes, I am the daughter of Black writers. We're descended from freedom fighters who broke their chains and changed the world. They call me. And it's just something I recite to myself, and it helps give me strength. I think as homework for anyone listening to this, I would just challenge you to think of the history that you stand on and the future you stand for, and to create something really explicit for yourself to repeat in times of darkness, just to remind yourself of the light that you bring just by living.
How are you 22?
I'm like 89 in like a 12-year-old's body.
Do you have another poem you'd like to share with us?
Sure. I will read another poem that I wrote called What Words Begin. And it was inspired when I was doing a bit of kind of historical research of when race really was used in the historical record. What Words Begin. The word race first arose in the English language in 1508. Of course, it appeared where all words are born. A poem. When a Scottish writer spoke of a long line of kings and the dancing, deadly sin of envy. So what is a poem, if not a beginning? An announcement that heralds itself. Moments of air molded like a melted wax. I always thought language was akin to the body, padlocked oh so delicately to a pulse. It tells you in the beginning was the word. This was before 1619, before Trayvon, before Till, before Malcolm and Martin and Michael went still. Before the echo that is breath's pilgrimage to the start of the sound. Before the inception of a new poem, when I am bent and gasping, stripped skinny, thatched thin, a wild note waiting to be sung. I am braced against beginnings I cannot name, my breath wheezing so hard as to stain the haze of night. My teeth are bared, my tongue a rare thing, flared and forked. I'm the damsel, the dragon, the dork, a furious flower. I dare you, bury me, wilting under your feet. For what is stepped on cannot be stepped over. So I'm still not sure if words are something the page pulls from me or the page pulls me from. All the same, I am partial to a we that is enviously gibbous, glamorous, letters clamorous in the damp dip of the tongue. Think, if sorrow made slaves sing, bronze faces polished with light, might we write a hymn that fills the mouth tight with wind? Maybe we can dream of lettering a lyric loud enough to crack the lung. I want to speak a blackness that is something to celebrate and something to shovel, the soil from which all of us start. Buried deep down within me, under the skin, like a secret skeleton, the shell that keeps us standing. Let our verses grab the globe by the ear, like a black grandma tugging a toddler straight. Let us arrive on the backs of words that give air its meanings, so that the next time historians speak of race, a long line of kings, they'll see us, our crescent smiles naked, nascent, shining so bright they make others black with envy. We tell the kingdom we are deadly in dancing, too. The heralds announce that our race has just arisen from the flower beds where our seeds have always been. We grin, recognizing our reign isn't words, but the world words begin.
Amanda Gorman is a 22-year-old poet and activist from Los Angeles, and she was the first National Youth Poet Laureate in the United States. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump was rallying supporters in Iowa last night, a sign that his fortunes may be slipping in a state that he won by nearly 10 points 4 years ago. Recent polls now show the Democrat, Joe Biden, with a slight advantage in Iowa, as Trump's support wanes, with women especially. Many voters disapprove of the president's handling of the pandemic. Like much of the Midwest, Iowa is reporting a spike in new COVID-19 cases. So with just a few weeks to go before Election Day, we asked our friends at Iowa Public Radio to go out and speak with voters. And we ended up here at a Friday night high school football game in DeWitt, a little farming and industrial town near the Mississippi River, population 5,310.
Here pass to McConaughey is complete for a Sabre first down.
The Central DeWitt Sabres are playing the Marion High Indians in front of a big crowd of at least a couple hundred fans. Masks are required and most people are complying. It also happens to be costume night and a lot of little kids are dressed up and running around in their Halloween costumes. Both the voters we met are in this crowd. Both have worked in education, but they couldn't be further apart on their thinking about the election.
My name is Donna Ellis.
Donna Ellis is a newly retired teacher, thankful she doesn't have to deal with going into school during the pandemic. But still.
I just miss people. I miss being around people. Like, it's fun to be at the game tonight because we can all socially distance.
And Ellis knows who she's voting for.
Donald Trump. He might not have the best bedside manner, shall we say. But I do believe in a lot of his policies. I'm pro-life, and I like the fact that he's probably a very good negotiator, and when he meets with foreign overseas situation, he, I don't think, would be easily pushed around.
As for the coronavirus, cases are surging in Iowa, up 16% over the past 2 weeks, and hospitalizations are at a record high. Ellis says she's not worried about the way President Trump has been handling COVID-19 or the fact that he tested positive himself.
Honestly, that doesn't bother me at all. My brother-in-law got COVID. One of my very good friends got COVID. Thank God they're both better.
Ellis was lounging on the grass along the sidelines of the football field. Many families brought their own camp chairs to spread out rather than sit in the stands. Closer to the end zone, we met another voter.
Hi, I'm Kevin Merrick. I'm 62 years old. I'm a Veterans Affairs coordinator for Ashford University. I deal with military students and certify them with the GI Bill. Born and raised here. I'm white, married, got 10 grandkids and great grandkids, and watching my grandson win a game. He's a starting center for the Sabres.
And Merrick has already decided who he'll vote for this election.
Totally Biden all the way. I'm an independent progressive. I was with Bernie in 16. I'm Bernie this year, but I got to go with Biden.
If Joe Biden is to win this election, he'll need progressives like Merrick to support his more moderate campaign. And like many Democrats, Merrick says the last 4 years have been tough on him and his family.
I've had friends that I've had for many years who've blocked me on Facebook because of my opinions. They're so diehard Trump. I've even got family members that have, you know, don't speak to me much anymore. Because of the way I feel about Trump, because they're fully behind him, and I don't understand why. Because to me, when I look at, hear their opinions, it's pretty much party over people. So the divisiveness of the whole country, it's torn us apart, and nobody cares about taking care of their fellow man anymore. But I looked at my grandkids, and I see promise. I see hope. And I think they're going to do good things. I hope. I pray.
That was Kevin Merrick and Donna Ellis, two voters in Clinton County, Iowa, speaking about how they're voting this election. Our thanks to Iowa Public Radio's Kate Payne, who went out to the football game and found Kevin and Donna for us. And for those of you keeping score at home wondering who won the game, Kevin Merrick's grandson and his teammates won 27-24. Go Sabres! And Tanya, we have a winner of our own to cheer about. Our very talented producer, Frankie Paris, got a new job.
I know. Frankie joined our team 2 years ago as an NPR intern, and we were so impressed that we actually hired her.
Yeah, Frankie was so good that she's moving on to be a reporter for the Berkshire Eagle newspaper in Western Massachusetts.
Best of luck, Frankie, and we really are going to miss you.
It's true. We will. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus will join us to look at this week's hearings and whether Amy Coney Barrett is on track for a quick confirmation to the Supreme Court. That's next time on Here and Now.